Welcome to the Better Birth Podcast. My name's Erin and I'm a hypnobirthing and antenatal instructor, birth activist and all-round birth geek. In this podcast, I chat to experts in the field of pregnancy and birth, debunking myths around birth, diving into the research around maternity care and exploring what is it that means you're more likely to have a positive birthing experience. If you enjoy this podcast, do feel free to buy me a coffee and fund my caffeine habit. Link to my Buy Me a Coffee page is in the podcast info. Enjoy this episode. Welcome to the Better Birth Podcast. Today, I am very excited to be talking to Dr. Nathan Riley. He is a OBGYN in the States. He left the medical system to focus on natural fertility and natural childbirth and holistic gynecology. He's a huge advocate for home birth. His youngest of his two daughters was born at home. And he's a prolific speaker, having featured on lots of other podcasts. His social media on Instagram and TikTok always garners lots of discussion thanks to his holistic approach to maternity care. And I know he's very like-minded, so I'm very, very excited to speak to you today. Welcome.
It's my pleasure, Erin. Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's fun to be on other people's shows because I do have my own podcast, the Holistic OBGYN podcast, and being in the hot seat as the host is way different from just being able to share what you've learned, you know, as you get on other people's shows. And so it's always an honor to be invited. So thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're so welcome. I found you on Instagram, actually. And, you know, some of the stuff that you put out there resonates so much for me as a birth worker. Like, you know, I hear lots of doulas and midwives talk about, you know, physiological birth. It's rare that you hear an obstetrician, a doctor, talking about, you know, physiological natural childbirth. So, I actually put out a call on my Instagram today to ask, where's all the UK obstetricians at? Because, you know, so far I've met you, I've met Dr. Stu, and, you know, I haven't met any, you know, passionate obstetricians who are really shouting from the rooftops about home birth and physiological birth. So I'm very excited to talk to you about this. But what I wanted to ask you first off is, did you know that you would be this kind of outsider, you know, alternative kind of OBGYN when you decided to train? Or is it something that's kind of progressively happened over the course of your career?
That's a good question. Of course, no. Of course, you know, I wouldn't have invested nearly $500,000 into an education program, you know, that got me all these great accolades and credentials and these letters after my name, really, really fancy stuff and medical doctor. Wow. How awesome. I wouldn't have invested in that if I, hadn't believed in it. And as you go through these years of training, I mean, it's like 14 years in the US. I know this education system's a little bit different in the UK, but actually really everywhere in the world, apart from Western Europe and the United States, where we do full thing of college, full thing of med school, full thing of residency, you do the full thing of fellowship. Elements of that appear around the world. But if you really want to be a doctor in the States, like, you better really be willing to pay up, not just in money, but in your time. So of course, if you're going to go down that path, you want to believe in it. You believe that you're doing good work. You believe you're going to be this type of doctor that really makes a difference. And I, you know, at the end of the tunnel, there was too much coming up for me in my own personal life and my relationships and really in my heart that was in conflict with my head. And that you can silence that, you know, but it doesn't make you a better doctor to just silence that feeling. And in one regard, so I'm also studying, so I've got two board specialties. I'm an OBGYN, but I'm also a hospice and palliative care doctor, meaning I do a lot of birth and I do a lot of end-of-life care. But I'm also studying anthroposophic medicine, which came out of the work of Rudolf Steiner. And Steiner is known for the Waldorf education system and biodynamic farming. And he also is known for this collaborative effort with a German doctor, or maybe she's Austrian, Ida Wegman. And they developed an anthroposophical approach to healing. And one thing that he writes quite a bit about is that this, so anthroposophic medicine is not alternative to allopathic medicine. It is an extension of allopathic medicine. And the reason I say that is that you can get all this exoteric knowledge, meaning these people are talking to you, you're reading books, you're looking at tissue under the microscope, you're getting in there, you know, into surgery and feeling tissues, like you're getting all of that knowledge. And that's helpful. But what happens when that stuff that you're expected to do in the operating room, in the birthing suite, in your interactions with women who are coming to you with very vulnerable concerns, what happens when that doesn't agree with the stuff that comes to you in deep meditation or in that flow state when you're walking in the woods, or it doesn't seem to jive well with what came up in your dreams last night, or perhaps you did a psychedelic journey and some epiphany happened? What happens when those two things are in conflict? Well, what we in the sort of modern world at large, what we would say is, if it's not in the data and it's not in your books, then it's not true. Well, that's harmful to the healer. It's harmful to the person that you're trying to provide healing to, because your intuition actually means something. There's a paper by an anthropologist, not anthroposophist, but anthropologist, like anthropology, studying cultural customs and norms and trends and and what have you, Robbie Davis Floyd, and her partner, co-author, was Elizabeth Davis. They wrote a paper called Intuition as Authoritative Knowledge among Midwives in Home Birth, or something like that. And they talk quite a bit about this, that midwives going to births are operating as much from their intuition as they are from what they heard in that recent presentation. Those presentations in the books and all the data and the journals and all that, yes, that's important. But if that conflicts with your real life experience, then we have a problem. Mm. So many, many doctors out there, and this is to all those UK OBs out there, like, I get it. I get that you did this. I get that you've invested. But if it's not really in resonance with how you feel, then there has to be something there to be explored. And I was fortunate enough to notice that there was this conflict early on in my training. Not so early that I could have put the brakes on and maybe stopped it, but I don't know if I should have put the brakes on, because now I can do what I do through a very, very different lens, a very compassionate lens. And so the esoteric knowledge of what you just know through your intuition, if it's in alignment with your exoteric knowledge, or you can just take the exoteric knowledge with a grain of salt, it's helpful for some things. It's helpful if you have a really bad blood infection. I know what antibiotic to provide or when to advise a person. I just had a client who, they were going to have a birth center birth here in the States. And they called me when her water broke, because there was a bunch of blood that came out, a ton of blood. They showed me pictures, and it's like a bloodbath in the bathroom. And I said, listen, you probably have a placental abruption. Call your birth center, but head to the hospital, because they're probably going to direct you there. And we don't want to lose time. We don't know what your baby's heart rate's doing. You know, we just want to get you there. So they went there, everything was fine, but she eventually had a baby, and they're home now and they're happy. But there was, so it was good to have that exoteric knowledge, but then something in my gut told me, we got to get you, like, you guys are scared. There's something going on here. We got to get you there. It's the combination of those two things that makes midwives so special. And I know, and you can maybe share a little bit about the UK's midwifery care model, but when midwives are driving the ship, especially in maternity care, leave gynecology and everything out of it, just attending a birth, you build a relationship with the partner, with the pregnant person, with their children, with their dog, with all of the people in the room, the doula. For me, I'm also developing a relationship perhaps with their midwife if I'm not the primary care attendant. And from those relationships, you start to get a little intuitive sense about when things are going right or wrong. But if I just show up in the room and you're having a baby, I have to rely on the exoteric knowledge, because I haven't built up that relationship, that rapport that I can divine, knowledge or expertise from through my intuition. It just isn't possible. So when we have these large practices where you just show up at the hospital, some random white guy with a bald head and a white coat walks in, I'm describing myself, everybody, and they're trying to execute the thing that they learned in the books and in their residency training and all their surgery experience or whatever, it's because they haven't spent the time with their clients to develop that knowledge base from which intuition is the primary driver instead of the head. Mm-hmm. So OBGYNs have gotten the head and the heart somewhat confused. And I say this with compassion, because I think a lot of doctors actually agree with what I do. They just don't really know how to apply it, because they've never been really trained or spent the time to really cultivate that intuition within themselves. Mm-hmm. But I bet if you ask them, what do you do for your kids? They're not going to the database and looking in the moment. They're just acting on intuition because they know what their kids' face is saying. They know what their body gestures are saying. They have a sense. It's no different from somebody who's really good at growing plants. They have a green thumb. It's not they have a magical power. Although if nowadays it seems like being driven by intuition is a bit of a magical power. But that person who knows how to grow plants, they're not going through every book and following a step-by-step protocol. They're just doing what they know the plant needs. And that's because they've developed a relationship with the plant, with the soil, with the berries, with the acorns, with the moon, with the sun. I mean, they're connected to the whole embodiment of what the beingness of a plant is. And it's no different when we, and it's actually even more important when we do that in more complex situations like birth. So that was a long answer, but I think if we can get back to valuing the intuition of midwives in particular and doulas, people that have developed relationships with birthing women, I think everything after that gets much easier.
Yeah. And I people can't see, but I've been like nodding along vigorously because I completely agree. And it's something that when I'm teaching my clients, I talk about intuition and listening to your intuition, because it's almost I feel like as women, we are taught to ignore our intuition because we're over emotional and we're driven by our hormones and all this, you know, patriarchal crap, which is utter rubbish. But I'll say to all of my clients, that intuition, you will learn as a parent to tune into your intuition and to advocate for your child when they are sick and your doctor is telling you there's nothing wrong with them, it's a viral infection, give it a couple of days, they'll be fine, and your gut is telling you there's something wrong. You will learn, you need to listen to that, right? And that doesn't start after your baby's born. That starts when you're pregnant. You know, from the moment you conceive, you need to be tuning into your intuition. And we suppress it, we ignore it. And, you know, your point on midwives is totally right. And I think independent midwives in the UK, when they listen to this, they'll be nodding along just as vigorously as me because they have that continuity of care. You know, they yeah. see the same person, the same family, they get to know their kids, like you said, you know, they get to look after them, do their antenatal appointments all the way through pregnancy, be there with them at the birth, and then see them postnatally as well. But unfortunately, in the UK, in the NHS, we don't have continuity of care. You know, we don't have enough midwives. You know, you're lucky if you get the same midwife at every antenatal appointment. And then, you know, most of my clients, when they go into labor, they're going to be greeted by a complete stranger they've never met before. So therefore, a lot of the midwives who are working on labor wards, you know, are also not getting to know the people that they're supporting. And like you say, that's an issue, not just for the obstetricians, but for the midwives as well.
Yeah. And a lot of the criticism from, you know, my colleagues about home birth, let's take home birth, for example, home birth is still around 1% of births in the United States. It's gone up from like point something to point something, you know, maybe 1.2%, you know, around COVID, because the hospitals were such a hard place to have a baby without masks and interventions and snow swabs. And so a lot of women were like, okay, we'll just have a baby at home. And it turns out actually things went just fine. A lot of the criticism that I hear from my colleagues around home birth, it actually relates to the cognitive abilities of this pregnant person. How could you be so stupid to want to do that? How could you, you know, be so irresponsible? You don't want your baby to die, do you? And what they're referring to is that, yes, there is a risk of mortality and morbidity in childbirth. But that's actually not what's driving a person's decisions around life and death. You know, if you ask a 95-year-old who has end-stage heart failure, do you want to be intubated on a ventilator? Most 95-year-olds, they've been in like 15 wars, you know? They're like, hell no, I don't want that. But we say, but you'll die without it. So that same, like, there's something about this fear of mortality that drives this criticism. And to add on to that, what I would suggest anybody out there, whether you're a midwife, you know, certified nurse midwife is a professional category that fits into this patriarchal hierarchy within our medical industrial complex. They're below OBGYNs, but they actually haven't ever been incentivized to sit with their intuition. So the professionalization of midwifery actually is becoming a problem in the United States in many regards, because they see the lay midwives, or, you know, direct entry midwives who went through apprenticeships, they see them as lesser than. I would disagree, because these CNMs, like the OBGYNs, are data-driven. And if you're out there and you're like, this guy's a total jamoke, whatever, I would just venture you to ask two things. Are you happy with how things are going in maternity care anywhere in the world, whether you're in East Africa or you're in North America or the UK? Are you happy with how things are going? Could this be improved? That's the first question. Most people are going to say, yeah, we don't like how things are going. The second question then is, are your, I'm not even call them patients, your clients, because you're not sick when you're pregnant. You don't have a disease. You're not a patient. You don't even belong in a hospital because you're not sick. But I digress. That one's going to rattle everybody's cage, right? But
it's true, though.
It is true. It is true. I stand by that. If your clients aren't happy, right, which could be reflected in more women asking about home birth, more women coming to people like me for care because they had a traumatic, even though it was an unmedicated, all natural, whatever, vaginal birth in the hospital, something didn't feel right. Their intuition was screaming the whole time that something's not right here, but they were being muscled out of that intuition through data, through medicine, through science. You know, you don't believe in science is suddenly now the criticism for people that are like, something doesn't feel right about this. So why are so many women having unmedicated natural vaginal births in the hospital? And then they hear somebody like me or you speak, and suddenly there's a little validation to that intuition that they didn't feel like something was right. That's because your intuition is authoritative knowledge, as far as I'm concerned. And I would never tell you that's the wrong way to raise your kid, because you intuitively know that my kid actually prefers to sit this direction or whatever else. Like, there's no data that's going to say otherwise. So why something that's so important? Why are women becoming increasingly dissatisfied and finding a voice through these types of conversations? The critic has to answer those two questions honestly and really, like with your hand to God, do you think things are going well? With your hand to God, do you think all women are really happy with the way that you shoved your hand in their vagina without really getting full consent? The answer is going to be no. A lot of women are not happy. Mm-hmm. So if you're not happy and your clients aren't happy, then why do we continue to bang our head against the wall by throwing data, get the CDC, get the WHO, get, you know, whoever, like get Joe Biden, get them, somebody's got to do something, Tony Fauci, somebody has to do something about this. Well, we've been throwing this solution at the problem now for over 100 years, well over 100 years. But with the displacement of midwives and home birth by OBGYNs and hospitals, we are not seeing better outcomes. So what are you going to do, doc? Like, you keep throwing more medicine. It's not improving the issue. Do you want to keep going down this path? Or is it time that we acknowledge that we're lost in the woods? And in order to get out of the woods, we need to go back and find a new direction. And that's the new direction that I have managed to find for myself.
It's interesting because the point you make about intuition and consent, you know, and birth trauma, is it resonates because the number of stories that I hear from people who reach out to me on Instagram who have had really traumatic experiences, and a lot of the time it's because they weren't listened to. You know, they instinctively wanted to get on all fours, or they instinctively wanted to push, and they're being told, no, you can't get in that position, or no, you can't push. And their bodies know what they're doing. You know, they instinctively know how to give birth, and they're being hindered by people on the outside who are saying, but that's not policy. That's not procedure. That's not how we do things. And they're not listening to the person giving birth. And that leads to trauma. And you're right. Like, something needs to change.
Right.
I feel like, unfortunately, I feel like a lot of hospitals, a lot of the institutions, you know, they cling to defensive practice. You know, they're clinging to the procedure and the policy and the research. So yeah, it's interesting because I do feel like defensive practice is driving a lot of the decisions and the way that we are treating birthing people. And the hospitals and the organizations that are caring, and I'm using air quotes here, caring for these birthing people, they're not putting importance on, you know, mental health outcomes or the physical trauma that can happen from, you know, a forceps birth and or pelvic health or any of that stuff. You know, the importance and the driving factor for the way that we treat birthing people is to prevent stillbirth. And yet we know, you know, if we look at the latest Embrace reports, which were published in the UK last year, you know, the number of stillbirths, it's single digit figures. You know, it's really, really small. It's a really small percentage. Now, I'm not minimizing the impact those stillbirths have because they are tragic, but they're not the only adverse outcome that comes from giving birth. And we are causing damage with the way that we're approaching birth, both in the UK and in the US, I suspect.
Yeah, I mean, you brought up induction earlier when we were chatting. And nowadays, yeah, what we've decided is if we can get the baby out faster, then we're going to have less stillbirth. Well, if stillbirth is the only number that we're looking at, then perhaps that's reasonable. The problem is, even these big trials that have looked at induction versus expectant management, 67% of women in the ARRIVE trial, which was 2019, maybe 2018 when it was published. No, it was even earlier than that because it had just come out when I was still in training. So it was like 2016, 2017. They had thousands of women who were eligible at many different centers, I think it was even many countries. And they offered them induction of labor at 39 weeks or expectant management, meaning we just let this go until you have a baby. And there's more to the study than that. But in effect, they found, let's say 20, I can't remember how many women were eligible, but it was a huge number. 67% opted out of the study. Meaning for them, something was telling them like, I don't know if I really want to be randomized. I don't really want to be a part of that. I kind of just like want to let my body do this thing. So you have 1/3 of all those women who go into the study. And sure enough, the study shows there's a 4% or something, 3 to 4% less likelihood of getting a C-section if you're in the scheduled induction group. And so now what has happened? Now we're scheduling everybody for inductions at 39 weeks because the ARRIVE trial said it was safe. Well, what people don't appreciate about that, and by the way, it also found that there was less hypertensive disease. There was less, there was a couple other statistically significant benefits in conclusion by the authors that suggest that 39 weeks is fine. Now, I don't think that the study was designed for this purpose, but given that we've already convinced ourselves that one stillbirth is enough for us to change every policy in the hospital and actually traumatize women through, you know, poorly consented vaginal exams, unvalidated fetal heart rate tracing systems, like this continuous fetal heart rate monitoring system is a totally separate can of worms. But since it's been generally universalized across the world, as far as I know, at least in the wealthier countries, we haven't seen any change to cerebral palsy rates. We've only seen increased C-section rates. And I looked at your data before we started recording. And in the UK, 1/3 of babies in Scotland and in England, in the very least, are coming by C-section. And that means that some areas are going to have far higher rates. So what I'm trying to demonstrate here is that when we find these interventions that are meant to reduce this one bad outcome to zero, we open up the possibilities of doing a lot of other harm. And just because we're not measuring it doesn't mean that women aren't feeling it and experiencing these things. And I think you're right on the money. You know, if a woman doesn't feel heard, if she doesn't feel seen, if she doesn't feel like she was really the caring person, the doctor, midwife, whoever, was really present in bearing witness to what they're going through, there's some trauma that comes with that because this is like not a medical procedure, guys. This is childbirth. And if you don't feel like you're being respected or spoken to in a certain way or touched in a compassionate way, your body's going to store that. I mean, this is a tremendously stressful, oftentimes orgasmic, oftentimes exciting, but also very stressful. There's no way around that experience. And if we're just going to continue to throw interventions to reduce this one down without looking at all the other possible, you know, immeasurable facets, you know, not, you know, maternal neonatal bonding is a great one. The ease and of lactation and breastfeeding early on. How about the connection of the father to the baby when he's not in the operating room and the baby comes out? Like, how does that play out in their bonding going forward? These are all the things that we could be asking. Not to mention self-reported traumatic experience, PTSD-like symptoms that develop after a poorly consented C-section while you're under duress. These are all these metrics that we could measure, which would be a good start. But furthermore, we're treating this like it's something we can control. And the more control measures that we seem to be putting in place, we actually are seeing worse outcomes, especially in wealthier countries. Mm-hmm. So we have to recognize that if we're really going to be scientific about it, you know, to play their game, and we're not going to outdata them, we're not going to out-reckon them through a materialistic lens of this process. There has to be more. We have to be more thoughtful and feeling into some of these decisions, as opposed to, you know, here's the numbers. Like, those numbers don't necessarily apply to you. And if you feel like something's off about the decision, you're probably right. Mm-hmm. But we don't give women or their partners the space to feel into that intuition. Instead, we just pull out the ARRIVE trial and we say, here's what we're doing because the data says it. Like, that's not even that much fun as a doctor to do that. It sucks. Like, what happened to the creativity? What happened to the you know, the excitement around the mystique of birth? That's been totally lost.
It has. And it even sometimes when, you know, when we talk about risk and we talk about, you know, the risk of poorer outcomes to justify these medical interventions, half the time we're not quantifying those risks either. You know, it's one thing that I advise all my clients is to ask for the science. If they're going to throw risk at you and they're going to be relying on evidence and research, well, then you need to see the research, you need to see the evidence, you need to see the statistics. Because are they talking about, you know, one of my clients got told that she has to have an induction because the risk of stillbirth was increased sixfold. And I was like, that's crazy. But she was switched on, right? So she said, okay, you say sixfold of what? And it turned out 1 in 3,000 at 37 weeks to 6 in 3,000 at 41 weeks. And she was like, that's like my math is crap. She was like, it's a 0.2% chance for stillbirth. I'm fine with that. I will forego the induction. I'm quite happy to stay pregnant. Thank you. I think if we're going to talk about risk, we need to be quantifying it.
Absolutely. And I don't know. I don't know if a vitamin K injection. Well, actually, we can talk about trial labor after C-section, because that one's actually really helpful. But let me also give you another example that you can carry forward. In the United States, it's universal that every kid is going to be given a vitamin K shot in the heel moments after birth.
Same in the UK.
To decrease the same. Okay. Mm. So not many doctors are offering any sort of oral bioemulsive drops. Not many are actually talking about the real risks. They say, you're right, the relative risk, it goes up by 10. Well, 10 out of what? You know, or what is the absolute value? What's the numerator and denominator so that I can actually use the data to make a decision? And there could be a reason that you don't feel good about the vitamin K shot, because somewhere within you, you're like, that seems like a pretty low risk, mm-hmm. even though you're telling me it's 6 times higher. Well, the actual data is that if you're in a wealthy country, the risk of bleeding, the baby bleeding inside of the brain or within the layers of the skull is 9 in 100,000 versus, you know, it decreases by like, I don't even remember, because it's so irrelevant. If it goes from 9 in 100,000 to 1 in 100,000, you've decreased the risk by 9, let's say. Mm-hmm. So you could say there's a 9 times less chance of it happening, but the absolute risk is still so low. Mm-hmm. So many of my clients, they want information specifically about that, but you could apply that same strategy. The way that relative risk and absolute risk are applied to almost anything is really problematic. So you mentioned you know, this dreaded, you know, uterine rupture after C-section. Maybe you didn't mention it, but it certainly came to my mind. The whole fear is that once you've had a C-section, now there's this weak spot on your uterus that can rupture while you're giving birth. If that were to happen, you've got an emergency on your hands. I have had it happen in my training. I've seen it happen. I've had some pretty unusual things happen with ruptures. Never did the woman die, but sometimes the baby was in distress and required some resuscitation afterwards. But the point is, it's less than 1% chance that that's going to happen. And what we like to quantify in most of the literature in the major journals, BMJ, we've got the green and gray journals here. Canada has their journal. All of these big journals, they love to look at maternal and neonatal mortality. the problem is not that many babies and moms die. Like, fortunately, not too many of these kids and moms are dying, which is so great. That's so great. The other problem is because it's so low, if we're only going to rely on that metric alone, then yes, having a C-section is safe. But what about the complications that arise when you've had four C-sections? We have big Amish communities here, which they'll sometimes have 14 pregnancies, you know, maybe 10 children. If you do a C-section unnecessarily in their first, and then they end up having another one later because you told them they can't have a vaginal birth because they had a C-section, and then they end up with three C-sections, four, five, 10 C-sections, the risk of bleeding, infection, damage to any of the nearby organs, abnormal placentation, you know, a placenta growing over the cervix and growing into the previous uterine scar, that's called placenta accreta. If it goes through, it can grow into the bladder. Now we're looking at one of the most highly technical, requiring three or four surgeons. You're going to use your entire blood bank at the hospital to do a massive reconstructive surgery in the pelvis during the birth of a baby. Not to mention all the other things, the stress of being strapped down crucifixion style during each of these C-sections, the 3 centimeters in front of you, this cloth piece of fabric or paper that's making it hard for you to even know what's going on in the room, you know, the delayed breastfeeding, the delayed bonding. Doesn't matter what the data suggests about these things. Women are saying, I didn't feel good after my C-section. It was scary as hell. And I don't want to do that again. Where can I find somebody that's going to attend to a vaginal birth? But less and less doctors are offering that without actually providing them the risks of all of the future pregnancies. So we're actually violating bioethics if we're not providing all of that information. Yes, we can get you through this one alive, but should we get you through it through a C-section? Or should we try to do this vaginally at all costs, even if the baby's butt first? Yes, I said it. Cringe, butt first baby. How dare we even talk about this? I thought this was settled. It's not settled. We're just simply not training midwives and OBGYNs to attend to vaginal breaches anymore. So we've got an unskilled maternity care professional, you know, organization that doesn't have the skills that midwives had 50 years ago. Like, we don't have the skills anymore. So now you're left with only one option, which is to have your breech baby in the hospital. And now you've been set up on the C-section pathway for the rest of your life. This type of risk counseling, this is what I do in my practice every single day. And when you provide all of this information and people can lean into their intuition, they make a decision that is right for them and they own the outcomes. Heaven forbid something bad were to happen. They made the decision. And something about that, as bizarre as it sounds to anybody out there who's stuck in this materialistic, reductive view of the human experience, something about that actually is fulfilling. That at least I was the one that made the decision. It led to a bad outcome. Shit. It led to a bad outcome, but at least I made the decision and I felt supported by my team. And hell, bad things do sometimes happen in childbirth. We are mortal. There are some times when babies or moms die and it's completely out of our control. Yeah. If a baby and mom died as a result of us coercing somebody to do a surgery that was unnecessary, or having a butt down baby through an abdominal incision and then they develop a pulmonary embolism or a amniotic fluid embolism, that's on us. Mm-hmm. And we've been unwilling to own that for the past however long we've been collecting data and writing in the written language.
Yeah, it's feeling in control, you know, and it's, that's one thing that I think is the thread across everybody who has a positive birth experience. You know, if you listen to the birth stories on my podcast, season 3 is just birth stories, and they're all positive birth stories, but they're not all unmedicated physiological vaginal births. You know, there's induction stories. There's people who planned a home birth and had an emergency C-section. There's forceps births on there. But they all feel positive because they felt in control. They felt supported. They were making the decisions. You know, one of the stories, she wanted a home birth. She intuitively knew something was wrong and said, I want to go to the hospital. She got to the hospital and said, none of this augmentation of labor crap. Get me into the theater. I want a C-section. And she got really shirty with them, was like, give me a C-section now. Had a C-section. Feels really positive about it because she made the decision to do that. She listened to her gut. You know, it all comes down to feeling in control of that situation, right? And then we take the control from all of these birthing people by telling them, no, you can't do this. No, you can't do that. Rather than supporting their decisions, giving them the evidence and the information, then allowing them as adults you know, to make those decisions. And I feel like it's unique in maternity care that we do this to people, to you know, pregnant people. You know, if it was any other aspect of our health, you know, the doctor says to you, well, here's some antibiotics and writes the prescription, it's down to you whether you go take it to the pharmacy and then take the pills, you know, or you can just say, no thanks, I'll just see how I go. No one's gonna coerce you into taking drugs you don't want, but when, as soon as we're pregnant, all of a sudden, be a good girl and listen to what I'm saying and do what I'm telling you to do and don't make stupid choices.
Yeah. I mean, we, as OBGYNs, we have to remember, everybody's like, there's two patients now. No, your patient is the pregnant person.
Mm-hmm.
Baby is not your responsibility. It is an organ system within this pregnant person. Your first responsibility is to make sure that they are safe, that I don't like the word safe, but to make sure that they feel heard. They feel like they've got control over whatever is controllable. There's not a lot that you have control over, but you certainly have control over signing a consent form for a surgery. And to your point, I've also had women who I just had one actually very recently. She had a breech baby. She was going to have a home birth and her midwife was super ready for this and everything. And at the last minute, she decided something doesn't feel right. I think I should be in the hospital. And that's okay. Like, my job is to provide you with the risks, benefits, alternatives, and then to support you in your decision. And I'm not using coercive language like, you don't want your baby to die, do you? That language doesn't belong in these really important decisions. Whether or not you have a hospital birth, a home birth, a midwife, an OBGYN, you get the vitamin K or not, I don't care. As long as you feel like you made a decision that felt good to you, then we're good. Like, it's not my job to tell you how to raise your kids any more than it is to have how to have a baby. But women are not, they're not really being received in that way, to your point. I really love how you said that.
Yeah. So you support midwives, right? In your business, you provide support to midwives in the US. So you must work quite closely with midwives. What's your view of midwifery care in the UK and the way that the maternity care differs from the US?
Well, I think in most of Europe, there's still maybe some hope, some optimism from people like me that midwives will still be respected as professionals without having to jump through the hoops set by these patriarchal, hierarchical, you know, three-letter organizations to prove to somebody that they know what they're doing. You know, let's take my guitar teacher, for example. This guy has I don't even think he finished high school. He definitely didn't go to college. He's never even studied music, but he has a sense of like experience with the fretboard. He can play guitar unlike anybody I've ever known. It wasn't because he was trained and has a piece of paper on the wall. It was because he actually took the time to really sit with this, his art, his craft. And that's what makes him so good at guitar. And he actually is a decent teacher too, it turns out. The same could be said for almost any profession, but what we've started to, and education, at least in the United States, has become an industry. Like, everybody's in debt with their educational bills. It's because the president of this university is making $4 million a year and all this other stuff. There's all this shit that's happening. Sorry for cursing. But when you go to medical school, you know, I'm like $500,000 in debt. I earned that diploma and I want to put that paper up loud and clear for everybody to see it. Now, I don't have them up because I actually don't really care personally. I actually think your apprenticeship starts when you finish your training. Like, you get to start practicing medicine. They don't call it perfecting medicine. They call it practicing medicine. When you've earned your accolades, you've got your papers, you can put them on the wall and say, I've started my apprenticeship. But it's not until you're maybe even at the end of your career that you can really say, I really know what I'm doing here. Midwives historically have been trained through this apprenticeship model. But in a world that only values the paper on the wall, they've tried their best. And in the United States, I mentioned the certified nurse midwives. There's two big bodies. There's MANA, which is the Midwife Alliance of North America, I think. And it supposedly is supposed to support all midwives. But then there's the I think it's called the ACRN or something. It's this other body that is all about the professionalization, and their body of midwives and their group is mostly certified nurse midwives. And the certified nurse midwives often speak poorly about this certified professional midwives and all the other direct entry midwife. There's all these other varieties. The reason I bring this up is that if we're going to continue moving towards making midwifery care and training sort of like a mirror image of what we've got in the OBGYN-led maternity care, we're not going to get better outcomes, because midwives, especially for the 85% of women who are low risk, in my opinion, you can argue low and high risk all you want, but I digress. For those 85% of low risk women, they're going to get better care out of the hospital with midwives. We have the hospitals, thank God, because there's some really highly trained surgeons there who are practicing cutting into the abdomen to remove babies expeditiously when we need it. But as midwives are trying to show their value by becoming more professional in the United States, they're leaning more into that exoteric and away from that esoteric, that intuitive knowledge. And some of the best midwives I know could care less about their title. They just are so comfortable sitting and being present with it and trying to soak in everything from the environment in that birth. Again, we're getting into that intuition process, that I would trust them with my own life. And if we were going to get pregnant again, I would trust them with my wife's and our baby's life as well. If you're going by the protocols and the didactics you learned, it tells me you're not ready. You're not ready to attend birth. So back to your question, I think that what we, you know, 50 years ago, maybe as recently as 50 years ago, and really 100 years ago in the United States, it included, midwives were really the ones attending birth. And then there was a shifting of this power dynamic. It actually is closely related to shifting cosmologies over the past several thousand years. You know, white rich men, they found a way to make more money off of this procedure, making it a disease process and making it a procedure, that midwives were started to, they've become lesser than. And I want to encourage everybody out there, if you're doing birth work in any form, you are not lesser than an OBGYN. An OBGYN has so much to learn from you. But if Europe is anything like the United States, the midwives are now having to prove themselves by publishing and doing research. And that's taking away from the craft, this beautiful intuitive process that guides how you care for another person. Just like how you have sex, like you don't look up how to have sex, you come together in a union with your sexual partner, and you make love. You're not doing the mechanics of getting pregnant, you're having sex. Like, it's really no different from that, and that might seem like a stretch for people, but the OBGYNs aren't having a lot of sex. Like, they are not very happy. They don't have any connection to something bigger than them. They're all miserable. They're all shitting on each other. They're all trying to show how great they are. Meanwhile, there are midwives out there sitting with the experience of childbirth. And that's what I think we're leaving behind if we continue to incentivize the professionalization efforts. Am I hitting anything here for you? I'm curious.
Yeah, I think for me, what we're losing is midwives getting to see physiological birth. It becomes like a vicious circle, right? Because people are pushed towards birthing in hospital, away from home births. Midwives are being, forced to suggest these medical interventions like induction, which can lead to cascades of further medical intervention, which means they're seeing less and less physiological, completely genuinely hands-off births. I know for a fact there's lots of student midwives who don't see any home births. You know, one student midwife I'm friends with said that she's never seen a truly physiological birth ever, and she's been studying for a couple of years, and it's because everybody has their placenta, actively managed with synthetic oxytocin. Maybe they had a vaginal birth up to that point, but we're still injecting drugs into the mother, which is going to have a hormonal effect, right? There's so many little things, and I feel like, and I don't want to overgeneralize, because there's amazing midwives out there. I know some personally who are passionate about physiological birth. However, I feel like some midwives are indoctrinated into this very obstetric way of thinking because that's all they know and that's all they see. And then they lose their way a little bit with some of the really simple things that we should be questioning and thinking, you know, like, and it seems crazy. Like every time I post on my Instagram about don't put a hat on your baby, the amount of people, honestly, the amount of shit I get from midwives saying it's really important. And I always get, where's the evidence? Where's your evidence? Where's your research? Like, it's basic physiology, you know? You need to smell your baby's head. You need to be able to get all those chemical compounds off your baby. It has a hormonal reaction on the mother and the baby. And then we're hindering it by slapping a hat on the baby. You know, there's these tiny little things which, you know, we do during birth and we intervene. And I feel like we're losing our way because we've forgotten the basics because we're so focused on the interventions to prevent the worst outcome.
Yeah, I'm not so sure how the training looks in the UK, but I'm sure it's pretty similar. It's kind of long hours. You're a special doctor. I'm talking about the OBGYNs in particular, but you don't have a lot of time outside of your like required work duty hours and your 100-hour work weeks. I mean, you're lying about your hours because you don't want to get in trouble because it's your fault that you were here too long or whatever. And I'm speaking from personal experience, but when I was in residency, I actually took a couple weekends and I went out into the field and went to home births with a couple people. And I don't think I would have been able to see a physiologic birth because when you're in the hospital, there's nothing physiologic about the constant distractions, the bright lights, the beeps, the right angles, like everything down to the quality of the water and the air and the food you're consuming when you're in the hospital. Nothing about this feels very natural. So when you go to a home birth, for anybody out there, if you have like an extra rotation, there was a med student who posted something on TikTok recently, and I stitched it and I said, she was like, advice to pre-med students, go and get clinical experience. You know, you want to be able to show how much you know, or I don't know what the point was, but I inserted that, hey, as a pre-med student, yes, that's going to look okay on your resume if you're trying to play that game. Why not instead go and find a midwife and go and watch a physiologic birth? And if that doesn't impact how you take care of anybody, whether you're a cardiologist, an OBGYN, or a radiologist for all I care, then I don't know what will, because seeing a physiologic undisturbed birth in a woman roaring while her baby's coming out without anybody talking to her, asking her stupid questions, trying to clean her baby off afterwards, the entire room is consumed with the energy of love. There's this vibrational frequency there that becomes a part of you. And not, there are a lot of people who actually feel this, but it's because they had a home birth themselves and they're like, oh my God, I get it. Many doctors and midwives don't, you know, if they're training in the system, and for us in the States, you'd have to be a certified nurse midwife to have hospital training. And some of them even assist with C-sections and all of this. Yes, you have credentials. Yes, you can act like you know more, but the feeling of being in a birth that is consumed by love. And this is borrowed a little bit from Michel Odant, but oxytocin, it governs over, you know, orgasm. It governs over conception by causing a quivering of the uterus, bringing the sperm up towards the openings of the fallopian tubes. It governs over the surges that are bringing your baby into the world. It governs over the milk letdown reflex. It governs over all of this, the fetal ejection reflex. And if you're interrupting that process by activating a person's fear centers, by asking them, you know, you don't want your baby to die, do you? You're squelching the not just the effect, but the entire environment that the baby is swimming in. And so as we continue to intervene and do this and act like our hospitals are the best way to do it, what are the downstream consequences of an entire generation of children being born not in love, not in this beautiful like vibration of just love and ecstasy and everything else that comes with natural undisturbed birth? You know, I think what we get is that the world we have today, where people are not really compassionate with one another, we don't really see this as more than just a meat suit that you live in for 90 years and then you die. When you feel that, you actually feel the same thing, Aaron, at death, that there is so much love here. It is not a bad thing to die. It's sad. We don't want to say goodbye. And it's certainly tragic if a baby dies. But a baby dying while being completely surrounded by love versus a baby dying while you've been poking needles and intervening and all this other stuff, those are two very different experiences, even for those parents who have to carry that burden often alone for the next 50 years of their life. If they ever, you know, move past it, which I don't think anybody ever does, they have to carry this now. Can we make this experience important again? As long as it's a medical procedure, we're not going to get anywhere. So if you're out there, go and see a natural physiologic birth. Find somebody that's consented to have you there. Be a fly on the wall. Don't say anything. Don't wear any cologne. Don't just make yourself invisible. The school for the neither seen nor heard, and just feel the experience. That is really, I think, the primary driver for where I'd like our maternity care systems to go. Mm-hmm. But we are such a far cry from that when even the midwives are trying to just pretend to be OBGYNs. And you're not a doctor, midwife. You're not. Thank God you're not. Be a midwife, because we need you to be a midwife. We need doulas to be doulas. Don't pretend that you're not, that you're one of these OBs in the long white coats. Don't pretend to be that, because we have enough of them and they're fucking everything up. Yeah. Sorry for cursing again. I'm a little charred.
No, it's fine. Swear away. I swear a lot. I do. I guess my last thought is it, which I'm pulling from one thing you said, is I do wonder if we will get 100 years down the line and there will be some kind of research looking at the impact of the way we gave birth and how that messed up an entire generation. Because how we come into the world matters, you know, the relationships, the responses, the bonding, you know, that shapes us and it shapes our relationships with our family for the rest of our life. And I think it is terrifying that we are hurtling towards the norm of a very obstetric-led, intervention-led birth. So I hope things change, and I hope, and this is why I wanted you on here, to be honest, because, you know, I think it's you as an obstetrician, you know, you carry authority, you know, and, you know, midwives in the UK and doulas and birth workers like myself are shouting this stuff endlessly. You know, in fact, I know you're going to be speaking to Kemi. I mean, she is vocal, passionately vocal about this stuff. But when it comes from an obstetrician, you know, I think people tend to sit up and listen more, because those are the people that we have been conditioned to believe and trust. So it's refreshing, and it's nice to hear somebody, you know, saying exactly the same things that I've been banging on about for ages. And again, I really, really appreciate you giving up your time to come and chat today.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you, Erin. I wanted to add one final comment about that. The Greek root for obstetrics is to stand opposed from, and it's been sort of co-opted, I think, as the term midwife has been co-opted by our government agencies. But, to stand opposite of while a person is giving birth, that holding space period, that's really, I think, where the magic happens. And I also think we can apply that same sort of attention to how we try to bring other people around. We're not going to convince them through data. We're going to stand shoulder to shoulder with them and support people in trying to figure this out. Going into OBGYN's accounts or their, you know, whatever, calling them out and saying, look how terrible this person is in this. Like, that type of attitude is not going to help us get anywhere. We need really a lot more love and compassion for where people are on their journey. And hopefully these conversations can help just open up the box of curiosities for people. Mm. It's not in my, despite what you think, I don't rattle cages because I want to be, to appear superior to others. I just want people to appreciate that, like, I see you for who you are. I see you for where you're at. And if I can be of service in trying to shift the world towards a better place, because if we want to get to a better world, we have to start with birth. If we're not birthing kids into a world of love, then our issues with racism and homophobia and bigotry and trafficking and all this other nonsense. Like, these terrible things can't be fixed if we can't even get childbirth right. So we have to be very, we have to hold space for people. We have to stand opposite them and just meet them where they're at without the intention of making them feel wrong or stupid. It's really just a matter of like, I hear that. I know why you feel that way. Hopefully it'll change in the future. Mm. And if you can act with integrity and continue to operate through your own intuition about where you want things to go, that's really the best we can do. So thank you for having me. Anybody listening, thank you. You're really the one that's going to take this conversation forward. And if anybody has any questions, of course, they can come and find me.
Where can they come and find you? And where can they find your podcast as well? Because I'm sure there's people out there that want to hear more of what you have to say.
Yeah, my podcast is a pretty unique take on women's health. It's not what you think. It's not like, let's talk about the cervix or whatever. It's really conversations just like this, where we get into archetypes. We get into alternative approaches to healing. We get into holistic lifestyle changes, but we also get into the crux of what we're all here for, is to try to fix the maternity care system and to make gynecology a little less confronting for so many women in the world. So it's called the Holistic OBGYN. You can find it everywhere. It's also, it's on YouTube, it's on Spotify, it's on all those places. And my practice website is Beloved Holistics. I'm going to be launching a Born Free Method course, which is a basically everything that you would ever want to know about your pregnancy and postpartum recovery. It's a whole year program that's going to be coming out in the next couple months. I also work with people internationally, believe it or not. Midwives have hired me to be, they've joined my membership program so that they can have some collegiality and camaraderie and consultation with an MD, an OBGYN. So if anybody's out there, you can find all of my services at my website. I also just launched a fertility program that's a truly holistic approach to fertility. That's a fraction of the cost of in vitro fertilization. And that's called my PRP fertility program. It's something I'm so proud of. So thank you. Yeah, you guys can find me all of those places, Instagram, Nathan Riley, OBGYN. Come and say hi. Just come and say, I liked this or I didn't like this about the show. And I'll know that you heard and that somebody was touched in one way or the other by it.
Thank you so much for your time today. I really genuinely appreciate it. And it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. And I can't wait to hear all the other things that you have to say on your own podcast.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you, Erin. It really is a pleasure. I mean that. Likewise.
Thank you.
The Better Birth podcast and all of its content is for educational and informational purposes only. You should consult your midwife or your doctor for anything in relation to your own pregnancy and birth. The opinions and the views of the guests on the Better Birth podcast are their own opinions and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Better Birth or Erin Fung.